Hello and welcome to episode 133 of The Great and Crowbar. My name is Chris Thurston, and today on the 17th of March, I'm joined by Tom Senior.
Good day.
We are the only two people
we're all that's left. They've all left us, Chris.
They have. Oh, I kicked the keyboard. It's already... Oh, fucked it already.
It's falling apart.
It's falling apart.
They've only been away for a few days.
So, Tom Francis is a GDC. Pip is a GDC. Marsh is in Sweden now. Graham is at home planning a baby. I don't know what he's... I mean, what that entails. It's due very soon, but who knows what that actually entails day to day for him. Presumably a lot of just thinking about having a baby.
Staring at himself in the mirror, just being like,
yeah,
what's about to happen?
Imagining baby scenarios. I'm not a father.
No.
It's probably obvious. So it's just you and I now. Left.
We get the good chairs, which is what I like about this arrangement.
We've managed to just move into two comfy chairs with our microphones.
Lovely. We're drinking red wine as well.
And a lovely glass of Merlot.
Merlot. Which we can never have when Marsh is here.
No.
I feel like we're being naughty.
Sorry, Marsh, because you're definitely listening to this.
I've ruined it.
I've cleaned the carpet. If anything goes wrong, it won't go wrong. We're very responsible.
Yeah, it'll be fine.
It will be completely fine. So this is GDC week, which means that technically it's a kind of a newsy week. GDC isn't normally necessarily a font for spectacular reveals. I suppose PlayStation VR was the thing, so much as it is a font for interesting anecdotes to be told by people who were there next week.
Yeah, it's both the most interesting and least newsworthy conference probably in the games journalist calendar for the lack of specific announcements, but kind of culturally and the kind of meeting of minds that happens in San Francisco every year at GDC is really exciting to just be around, which makes it quite hard to pitch to your bosses. It's like, I want to be around it. And they're like, what are you going to get out of it? It's like, some news, perhaps.
I just feel a greater connection to my peers. Exactly. That's all I really want. And that is an excuse. That is a euphemism.
Oh, my.
Being drunk.
Has anything happened at GDC this week? Microsoft are still kind of fending off, they're destroying everything.
A multi-man melee at the center of GDC for the last couple of days.
They're playing a kind of tower defense game at GDC where developers line up and charge them.
Come at Phil Spencer one after another.
Yeah.
He's like, 3 days in now, he's starting to flag. It's like that Batman comic when all of Batman's villains escape from Gotham at once.
Oh, gosh.
And he's eventually so tired out that Bane manages to break his back.
He's in a bomber jacket, clutched onto the bottom of a lorry, trying to escape.
Yeah, exactly. That is the plot of Batman Nightfall, not Phil Spencer's GDC so far.
Well, it's to be seen, really. I mean, it could end anyway. But yeah, Microsoft did a press conference and tried to make everything look brilliant. But that's an ongoing news story, isn't it, really?
Mm. As it happens. Also, apologies if you could just hear me adjusting my microphone stand. It's doing that thing where it likes to very slowly sink towards my crotch as I'm talking.
It's quite disturbing. I was watching it.
Yeah.
Just going down on you.
So, already a shambles.
Yeah.
I'm afraid, this podcast, but it's fine.
But we've been playing some games.
We have been playing some games. I would like to talk about... To start off with the thing that I think... You've also been playing, but anyone spoken about on this podcast yet? Which is The Division.
Yes.
Which has proven controversial.
Yay. Yay. I'm not going to be able to avoid using that, the word.
No, it's going to happen. The forbidden D.
So we, PC Gamer reviewed it and gave it 68 out of 100, Chris. What do you think that is a good score for that video game?
If I were to review it...
No, you just want to silence. You're not allowed to say.
If I were to review it, I would probably give it a 6.
Okay, there you go.
But
I think IGN gave it like 6.7. Apart from that, it's been quite widely enjoyed. Lots of 8s.
It's sort of weird because I find myself wanting to like it. Like, I think you and I had the same response to it, which is when I'm playing it, I'm thinking, this is like a 7. But then when I'm thinking about it using my brain... It's not a 7 anymore. And I had to do some soul searching to figure out how I felt about it. Like, so to clarify, The Division, if you have somehow not noticed the relaunch of apparently the biggest new property in video games ever.
Apparently.
It is a MMO shooter set in the Clancy universe or a splinter of the increasingly... That doesn't really mean anything. It means it's set in the modern day and there are guns and gadgets. Set in post-disaster New York. Your character is a sleeper agent for the US government, apparently. Maybe, perhaps.
I don't even understand what you are. I've played it for about 20
years. Activated to restore order in New York, which within 2 weeks of everyone getting sickly because the bad money has already plunged into looting and rioting. And, I don't know what angle to attack The Division on because it's fascinating in so many ways. I think one thing that struck me really early on with it actually is it's easily the most right-wing Tom Clancy game I can think of.
Hmm.
And that, I mean, all Tom Clancy games have a bit of it, right? But they're all in this kind of interesting, like, I find the politics of those games really fascinating because Ubisoft generally are quite progressive with their, like, they're in the real, well, I don't know if that's actually the right word. They're in a really weird tension. Like, most of their games are about overthrowing autocratic leaders, right? Like, the entire Assassin's Creed series is about sort of this anti-authoritarian, you know, sort of Brotherhood of Man versus, you know, sort of monolithic power structure kind of thing.
Mm.
Where, and then the Far Cry series is kind of about underdogs versus overdogs and literal dogs.
Yeah.
But it has its own problems with its, you know, well, it's, we talked about in a previous episode, its vast kind of like colonial kind of weirdness that it gets into every single time. Clancy is traditionally like the good army, proving that you still need the good army because when the army goes bad, it's bad.
I mean, I think when, as soon as you encounter the phrase activated cell, then you're getting into some interesting territory when it comes to like, you know, the Division is about turning New York back into a frontier, isn't it? And about people with guns then fixing it.
Yeah. It's like you're there to restore order to the city, and like the Division as a concept is sort of described as like emergency disaster relief of these citizens that are trained to be activated and then work on behalf of, you know, society in the event of a major catastrophe. And it's rooted in all this real, you know, sort of worst case scenario planning that I think was done in the US in the last 10 years. And, you know, that presumably in real world would encompass relief work and medical aid and stuff, but you literally just shoot people all of the time. And your enemies are looters. They are people, you know, raiding, you know, well, they would be trying to get supplies, but actually what they're trying to do is kill the supplies.
Yes, that's
because if there's a supply drop and you need to defend it, then the looters will come to shoot the supplies, which is not what looters do.
I thought the supplies have a health bar in this context. Yeah. I think one of the awkward things about the Division is that the way it tries to, you know, tie up its vision with its mechanics, and that it's constantly in friction with its own fantasy. The way it works, it desperately wants to work like a traditional MMO, but everything you see in it and everything that it tells you about its world is that it's this violent, difficult place. And then you attach a cover sheet to where everyone can take 50 bullets onto that, and that doesn't work.
No.
And it just is constantly bumping up, you know, against itself.
Like, I mean, we get bored with the concept of ludonarrative dissonance, sorry for saying it, but it has to be said. The Division is like one of the most fascinating case studies in that. Hang on, drink.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but yeah, like, so essentially the fantasy of the Division is that society has gone to shit. Opportunistic looters are everywhere. And that is not the silliest of that game's factions.
No.
By any stretch. The solution to this is to shoot people essentially on site without any, you know, jurisdiction. If you ping an environment with your scanner and someone flashes up red, you should just murder them.
Hmm.
If they're wearing a red hat, you should just kill them in the street with a gun. And all this stuff is, if it wasn't such a thick RPG coating over the top of it that makes everything that happens in the game meaningless, I think a lot of that stuff would be quite uncomfortable given America's present relationship with people looters getting shot in the street. But the overtones are like, essentially, when government fails, it's down to individual citizens who own their own weaponry to take to the streets in their comfortable winter clothing and just start fucking gunning people down until society makes sense again.
Mm.
Which, like, it's kind of, if you weren't working technically for the government and to restore the government, and you were in fact just some, you know, an NRA member with a concealed carry license, it would be the American paranoid right-wing fantasy game.
So 10 out of 10.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's really such a strange, like, it took me a good couple of hours with it to move past the absurdity of the setting, the disconnect between what you're being asked to do and what you're being told that you're doing. Particularly given that it's set in the modern day and you're being asked to treat these looters as like goblins that you're just gunning down en masse, but you're also being asked to believe in it because they've invested so spectacularly in the storytelling and the cinematic side of it.
Yeah, I mean, the best goblin moment is that, so you've got the cleaners, who are the faction who just burn things. And
so we should actually back up and explain that the cleaners are a faction of evil firemen who've decided that the only way to save New York is to burn all the civilians, so they don't spread this virus any further. They can't be convinced out of this stance, even though it's stupid. And yeah, as you close in on their leader, he'll shout things like, "I don't care who's attacking us. We have to set fire to everybody to save the world." But then, as I imagine you were going to say,
yeah,
you do find him.
you find his boss arena, which is at the top of a tower, I think.
Yeah, top of a skyscraper.
Yeah, top of a skyscraper. And he's in there, and it's a nicely designed cover shooter level. And he's getting dressed. He's being dressed by his minions.
Yeah.
And they're putting various layers of kind of flame retardant armor on him and hanging massive kind of casks of gasoline off him so that he can flame harder and longer than any of his other guys. And he's literally like 9 foot tall and he's about 6 foot wide. He's just a giant meat brick. And he was like a Destiny villain.
He is the biggest fireman of
the he's the largest. And therefore he gets to be in charge.
Which is complete Goblin King logic.
Yeah, so funny.
So in a traditional RPG, the notion that you'd eventually track down the leader of this raiding party that had been attacking the village and you would track them down to their lair and then fight their leader that was the biggest one. You could substitute orcs, goblins, skeletons, anything for that. In this case, it's just firemen. And and you're being asked to believe that this is like still a Clancy game. It's still kind of like, you know, head on, chin on fist. Like, but what if it could really happen? So that's totally absurd. Like, I find actually killing the cleaners less objectionable, or less, like, that was when for me the sort of like, holy shit, this game is fucking strange politically, started to fade for me, because they are explicitly
just too stupid
villains.
Yeah.
And they have big fuel tanks on their back and you shoot them and they explode.
Yeah. That's the best part of the game. That moment where they pop is the best thing in the game.
Yeah.
But once you've done it 20 times, you know, that's it really, isn't it?
The thing about it is like, it's not bad. Like, it's not terrible. Like, I mean, the disconnect between what you are, between what you're doing and the story you're being told is a big problem for it. And I think the setting comes back to bite it in a lot of other ways. But it looks phenomenal. Like, it genuinely really does look incredible. It's the best New York in a video game, and there's been a lot of them.
Yeah,
it benefits enormously from the fact that you have to explore it on foot. So they don't have to worry about how to do traffic, but it's full of these like amazingly detailed individual corners. It's that full weight of Ubisoft pointing thousands of people at a thing.
Yeah. And into a much more concentrated area. It's like, it's not a huge area. Like it's smaller than Assassin's Creed game.
Yeah.
But it's, what if they focus all of that into a narrow strip of New York, the island of New York. And the results are extraordinary. The lighting alone is just amazing. And the way that, when there's a hailstorm, the hail, like the snow catches the light in different ways, like, accurately, and it's all dynamic. And the snow underfoot just deforms accurately, and just it's extraordinary. Yeah. It's really extraordinary technically.
I was walking through the dark zone, I think, the other day, which we'll get to, and I just saw like there's a street corner, there's a series of stands because the virus apparently happened on Black Friday. And there's just a series of like street stalls selling Christmas trees. And I haven't seen that repeated anywhere else in the game. Like, it's not one of those games that has like repeated assets everywhere.
No, that's true.
That you can't believably repeat, like New York cabs and stuff. Like, and that sense of that you're actually exploring a real city at the basis of it is amazing. And it's probably one of the strongest cases outside of GTA 5 for, God, why don't developers just let each other use each other's spaces?
Yeah.
So that's great. The UI, I think, is amazing. Like, they've really done a good job with that.
I'll go back and forward on it, because I can't stand the bobbing health bar thing next to your body. I think it's just this is just that you either love it or hate it. And I kind of find that between the numbers and the health bars and the way that if you focus on an enemy for after a certain period of time, you see a kind of spindly skeletal series of kind of red marks that kind of, I think when you pulse, it also does that.
You can tag them.
So you tag them.
It's a Ubisoft game, so you can tag
them. And I think it can occasionally get really, really busy. But other aspects of it are really, really nice. Like the fact that you can see how much, every time you put something in your backpack, a little kind of overlay over your backpack tells you how full your backpack is and kind of what's going on there. And the, I got used to the nav stuff. That's really nice. The map, you just kind of press a button and it creates this holographic map of New York around you that you can then kind of plot fast travel points and things like that, and that's really nice. But it's quite busy.
It is busy. They're going for that kind of, like, you know, when people really thought that, like, Google Glass and AR was going to be a big thing. And like,
sort of like that.
People would do those kind of like proof of concept videos of, like, you know, this is what the world would look like overlaid with all the data. Like, it's that basically. And it's really nice to see that. Like, I really like it. It's really slick. Like, the game had some like connectivity issues at launch, but it feels super sort of crisp and slick to play. Like, it's very good at letting you know what the outcome of your interaction with the environment is going to be, and like your cover to cover system works nicely and that kind of thing. Like, it's very crisp. And it's an okay shooter. Like, it's, but only an okay shooter. It suffers, as you gestured at with Giant Fireman, for enemies with enormous health bars, which is, that's like one of the many strikes against its setting. Like, if you wanted to build a shooter RPG where you were going to moderate challenge by having some enemies take huge amounts of bullets, then modern day New York fighting men in hoodies is not the setting for you. Like, you just can't justify it in the fiction. It doesn't look or feel right to be facing a man with a baseball bat in a baseball cap who's charging at you. And you spray him with bullets, and then you have to keep backpedaling, reloading, spraying him with another clip of bullets before he goes down because you're afraid of being hit with a baseball bat. Like, everything about that interaction has broken the setting. Like, it's fine mechanically, because if he was an orc, that would be fine. If he was an alien,
he's a fireman.
It'd be fine, but he's a fireman.
He's a fireman.
He's a fireman's friend in that case.
I like to think that, like an orc, any fireman that disagree with him get eaten. He eats them as a show, as a display of his kind of prowess. He just gobbles them up. That's why he's so large.
He's eating all the other firemen.
He's eating all
weaker
the firemen. All the firemen who stood against him in his belly.
All the firemen that pointed out that what they were doing was the opposite really of what firemen
stupid.
Do.
Stupid.
So like, and this sort of like dials back to, I think, a criticism that was in the PC Gamer review, and that I ended up writing up in more depth yesterday because we need them hot takes, which was that essentially, like, I don't know why it's an RPG. Like, fundamentally don't know why it's an RPG.
I mean, it's an RPG because this is the new thing, isn't it? This is the, you want the everlasting, persistent kind of MMO shootery type thing that can keep players hooked for years and becomes a big new service. And that's if you can pull it off, that's a huge amount of money that's going to be coming in every year.
And for sure, and it's worked. That's
exactly.
But it's like
pretty worked.
Like, the scenario in that game you find yourself in is like, oh, I'm level 6, my favorite gun is my M1 sniper rifle because I like popping the fireman with it. Feels real nice. But then I get to level 10 and its health flashes up a thing to say your weapons are under level, do you need to replace them? And I can't afford or find or craft another M1 with better numbers. So I start using a shotgun for a bit or something in the same slot. And then at level 11, I find another M1 and I go back to using the M1. And when I fire the M1, it takes off proportionally the same amount of health off a level 11 enemy that my old level 6 M1 would have taken off a level 6 enemy. So even though I've technically leveled up and fiddled with my inventory a whole bunch and had to make some decisions because of the way the RPG system works, nothing meaningful has changed about the way I play my character, apart from the fact that I'm now allowed to use that gun again because the arbitrary ramping health system permits it mechanically. And in that time, I have gone from being a man in a blue jacket with brown pants to being a man in a brown jacket with blue pants. And like, that is your reward for another 6 hours spent in the game. Like, it's so fundamentally not good as a loot game that I really worry that it's not going to have longevity because I can't imagine getting excited. Like, you go and look at like what's the best gear at level 30, which is the cap, and it's just gold, which is the highest quality level versions of stuff you can be playing with at level 4.
Yeah,
it's like you want a Vector Tech 9 and the best knee pads, and you're not going to really look any different to how you looked then. You're going to be using guns that behave in exactly the same way. They have some more perks and stuff, but like, if you consider what it means to be starting and at level cap in any other game like that, from World of Warcraft to Destiny to Diablo, it means a hell of a lot more than that. Like, it's your reward for getting to the end of the grind is like, good job, you finished the grind. Here's the same stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting to think back to games like APB, which was like just mechanically duff. The sheeting was rubbish and a lot of it was kind of balked, but it had quite an interesting sense of fashion to it and a very in-depth character creator, and they had old fashion districts, and they'd clearly kind of thought carefully about how people could become individuals in their world.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
And there's actually nothing like that in The Division. It is sorely lacking.
It's kind of interesting that The Division is kind of APB with a budget.
Yes, done better, much better. And
yeah, for sure. Done much better, but that's the game that it is. Mm. Like, yeah. Defiance would be the other game it reminds me of, which was total rubbish. So it's sort of, it's one of those things where it looks like it was really hard to make The Division, but unfortunately I'm left wondering why. Like, you know what I mean? They pulled it off, damn it. And they have this amazing talent for the environment and the interface and, you know, fundamentally competent design in every other regard. But it's like, it's a quixotic thing, right? Like, to try and make Tom Clancy into World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
And expect those things not to just fight each other.
Well, a lot of people don't seem to mind. And I think the counter argument that a lot of people have made is that it's actually quite a good tactical co-op game in some ways. And I've not really necessarily experienced that. It's more fun to roll around with someone because that's always more fun in any game.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I've never really... I mean, I was playing it with Phil. We were just kind of marching up and down streets, mostly in silence, just kind of popping heads and not really doing much else. And there's also the Dark Zone, I suppose, and that's people really enjoy the Dark Zone, kind of get a lot out.
So the Dark Zone, so Dark Zone's worth talking about because it is that game's sort of biggest font of original ideas, I think.
Yeah.
And it's genuinely good. Like, I sound so down on the game. This is the thing I was talking about, where it's like, when you're playing it, you're like, oh, I'm having an all right time.
Yeah.
Then as soon as you stop playing it and start thinking about it or start talking about it critically, all I can think of is the problems with it. And I should stress that, like, you know, I was one of those people who was on the other side of the fence with Destiny saying, you're all maniacs for giving it 6 out of 10. This is my favorite game in the last couple of years.
Right.
The Dark Zone is the PvP area in the center of the map. And if the rest of the game wants to be World of Warcraft, the Dark Zone is where it wants to be DayZ. Because it is between those poles, right?
Like, yeah, it is.
If there was a cynical decision behind this game, and I'm not saying there was, it was, DayZ is really big. World of Warcraft's really big. Everyone's trying to make a shooter MMO work. How do we make all of these things happen in the same game?
And then Tom Clancy as well.
Yeah, and why not?
Wraps around all of it.
And so the Dark Zone is like this stretch of central Manhattan, which is walled off with checkpoints. The idea being that there's no communications in there and all the loads of agents have gone rogue and there's loot everywhere and stuff. So you go in, and while you're in there, you get different currency and different XP for your Dark Zone level. And then any loot you find is probably going to be much better than anything you find outside the Dark Zone, but it's contaminated. And in order to get it for use, you need to get it to an extraction point, which is like a helipad in the street. Fire a flare, wait for a minute and a half, attach your baggie of shoes and hats and knee pads and guns to the helicopter, at which point it's sort of taken away and it appears in your stash outside in the game proper. The twist being that all the enemies in the Dark Zone are really high level, so just the PvE side of it is hard. And also, there is full friendly fire with all the other players you encounter. And the Dark Zone is the only part of the game where you encounter players you haven't invited. So even though we call it an MMO, it's less of an MMO than almost any other game, because it's not even like, outside the Dark Zone, there aren't even social... Well, no, actually, there are social areas, because there are the safe houses. But most of the time, you'll either be doing a mission or in your own base that you can upgrade. And all of that stuff happens completely, basically offline, unless you opt to have other players in it.
Yeah.
Like, you won't just see another player in the street normally at all. In the Dark Zone, you will. And those players can shoot you and take your stuff. And I don't know how you find it, Tom. My experience of it was that I found DayZ took me 20 hours before I felt like, or even more, I played 60 hours of DayZ. But I think after 20 hours, I'd seen every story that could really happen. Like, not obviously because it's such an open-ended game. Obviously, there's infinite variety of the ways those scenarios can play out. But I wasn't going to, I was seeing the same things play out over and over again, like pinned down by a sniper, or there's a guy shooting newbies on the beach. I've run out of food. I've been poisoned, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not so much that I got bored, but I think it was just like, I've kind of feel like I've rinsed this of its narrative, you know, emergent story driving weight now. I felt like I got that way with the Dark Zone within 2 hours.
Mm.
I don't know if that matches your experience of it.
Yeah, pretty similar, to be honest. It's just that I only saw one rogue person and they went rogue by accident. And it seems that things get interesting as soon as rogue players start happening, but it doesn't seem like players are very incentivized to go rogue at all.
No.
Unless they're very high level and can survive easily.
But even then, like, the reward for... So if you go rogue, you shoot another agent, you get a bounty on your head, every other player can see you on the map, see where you are. They get a massive bonus for taking you down. You get a bonus, or you obviously get whatever you stole, and you also get a bonus if you... like escape or survive until the timer ticks down, but that bonus isn't very much. And if you die as a rogue agent, you actually lose progress in the other bars, the bars that matter, the bars that get you towards your reliable rewards.
Right.
And so while you do see the odd person go rogue, or you see groups of people who've gone in for that purpose, for the most part, if people are just in there to get loot, and that's most people, it's better for everybody if everyone quietly cooperates. Like, if you go rogue, you better hope that the person you kill had a good item on them, because you're about to get gunned down by everyone else because they want the easy reward for killing you that comes without risk to them.
Yeah.
So, like, it doesn't, for me, like, because it's annoying because you see, like, there's a great video earlier I saw on the internet of someone taking out four rogue players at once with a sticky bomb.
Yeah.
And it looks great. At that point, I'm like, oh, man, do I like the Division now? Like, because those moments seem really cool. But, like, in the time I played it, I had my moment where I furiously defended the landing zone because I wanted to extract a pair of jeans. That was because I those jeans, man. I found some faded jeans.
I had some fucking awesome chinos, man. I had to get them out of that place.
I found a purple hat.
Stylish chinos, they were called. They called them stylish. Just that's like, in a fantasy game. That
I need a helicopter. Yeah. Why?
Stylish chinos.
We've got stylish chinos down there.
Got to get them out of here.
Yeah.
Waste enormous resources sending a chopper to hover over this location under enemy fire and extract them immediately.
Yeah, we can just buy you some trousers. No, I want these ones.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. It's kind of interesting.
No, it doesn't make any sense.
There's a nice moment of standoff and a little bit of tension when the chopper arrives. And all the friendly players, like, you have to fend off a few waves. Because you send off a big fuck-off flare that just attracts a load of NPC enemies.
Because looters love flares.
Oh, yeah. Flares equal chinos. They've learned.
They're coming for your chinos.
Pavlovian response they've learned. So they start charging location and stuff. And that's a good time to go rogue if you're going to go rogue, where people are distracted by the enemies. But then once you've gone down all the just men in hoodies who are desperate to survive and eat chinos and continue living, there's a kind of a moment where everyone's standing quietly around. And something, some shit could happen. There's a feeling that something could go down. But after about like 6 or 7 times of doing it, I'd realize that nothing's ever going to go down. Cause as you say, everyone's incentivized just to be a good person and, just quietly extract your shoes and then leave.
Yeah.
Go your separate ways.
Like one time when I was at the extraction point, it was like me and another guy. And then the other guy just got gunned down out of nowhere by a rogue player that had run up. And then I killed the rogue player and got the big reward for it.
Mm.
And I felt great. I was like, yeah, I got him.
Yeah.
But like every other time I've encountered a rogue player, I've either been absolutely loaded down with loot. So it's like, fuck fighting. I'm just running.
Mm.
Like I'm running to where loads of other players are because then everyone will gang up on the rogue player if they choose to chase me.
Yeah.
Or I've had nothing to lose because I haven't found anything yet. Mm. So it's like, fuck it, I'll just go for it. Like, I can respawn nearby. It's not like DayZ, like, where... That's the thing, like, the reason DayZ works, the reason it creates drama, is because it's brave enough to confront you with real fucking stakes for getting it wrong. Like, yeah. if you've got a character and you've been working on it for a while and you've raided a few buildings and you've got enough supplies to live and a gun and stuff, then maybe you could step in to help people who have been pinned down by someone who's hunting other players. But you do that at the risk, you know, only take one stray bullet to mean 20 hours of progress is lost or whatever, like hours of progress. At least. Yeah. The Division isn't like that. You don't lose anything. If you are an innocent player and you get gunned down, you lose nothing apart from the items you have on you. And you're at any point able to make the decision to play it safe with those items. So you might as well just, like, you know, if you want to go hunt rogue players, you totally can. You can just roll in, don't bother picking up any loot, run straight at them, and there's no penalty for that.
Yeah.
And that really, like, I respect the desire to try and find a mainstream way of doing that kind of, like, you know, social drama multiplayer thing, but realistically it needs both better reward systems and more punishing risks.
Yeah,
because it simply doesn't really work as it is.
Be interesting when they introduce the raids, which are coming in the next couple of months, because that will give players the incentive to kind of mine the dark zone, and that might encourage more conflict there. So maybe this, you know, if you really need that high level gear to get to do the raid stuff, then maybe you're more likely to.
At which point the fiction is completely fucked.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm going to save America, I need to kill all the other people who are trying to save America.
And then go into this, this sewer or whatever, wherever it will be set.
To fight the biggest looter.
To fight the giant Riker. Riker's another one of the factions.
Yeah, not like Star Trek.
No, that would be a better game.
That would be a much better game.
The third faction you come across are just, almost like SWAT team. They're all wearing kind of SWAT.
Well, it wouldn't be Tom Clancy if it wasn't like evil.
Yeah, it's like Rainbow Six gone bad. Yeah, it's the evil Rainbow Six.
The six is upside down.
They're lurking in the northeastern corner of the map, and they don't go anywhere else. It's their high level zone. They can't go anywhere else because that's the zone they have to be in to give the player a threat.
They're too high level for the zones.
Yeah. Weird game.
Weird game.
I think it'll be interesting to see how it evolves. They've got a lot of expansions planned for this year. It's slightly disappointing that the first one is just going to be underground, when that setting is so amazing that the last thing I want to do is just go under it.
So the first expansion is raids, basically, which I don't know how they're going to add meaningful diversity to them at all. Like, I mean, maybe, you know, like, what are you going to find loot-wise? It's making you going to go, wow, you know, I was there, man. Mm. Like, you know, wow, I found an AK-47 and a beanie. Like,
I'd love it if they looked at Destiny and they had, like, pads you have to stand on that glow and you have to fend off waves, and it's a big puzzle dungeun under New York City.
They're so committed to their setting.
Yeah, it's true.
Like, that's the thing, is like, it's like they've done it on hard mode. Like, they've given themselves the setting that is the hardest to make that game work in. Of anything. Like, if it was an alien invasion in New York instead, they could solve all of these problems. Mm. As you level up, you start getting access to alien gear and abilities and stuff.
Mm. Could still happen.
It's not going to.
Division Year 2.
I don't know. Like, it would be fascinating to see if they ended up going, like, fuck, no, this game does need robots.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm not saying that you can't, like, modern military isn't sufficient as a setting in and of itself. It's fine, just not for this. Because if the game is built around loot, then you need some escalation.
Mm.
And, like, you can't, like, I'm a sucker for this stuff. I was excited to find a parka, a cool parka was the description.
Cool parka.
Cool parka. Nice. Like, I'm going to be the cool parka guy. I'm going to walk in and people are going to go, check out that guy in his parka. No one is ever going to fucking do that. Like, that's probably an idle daydream the best of times in other MMOs. The idea that you'll go back to the social hub and someone will be like, look at that guy in his gear, which is always the promise, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you rock up in World of Warcraft riding a fucking celestial horse.
Yeah, you notice.
Glowing.
You notice that shit.
Yeah, people notice that shit. But, like, you know, a sad man in a beanie with a scruffy beard walks in a cool parka. And you're not exactly. It's like the setting doesn't suit the system, but they built the system anyway. And that's the story of that entire game.
Oh, well, that's the Division then.
Yeah.
I'm sure. I mean, people love it. So,
they do, yeah. And I keep thinking, should I play it again?
Tell us why. If you like it and we're wrong, tell us why we're wrong.
Yeah.
By getting in touch.
Or just leaving comments on PC Gamer this week.
Yeah, God.
Yeah.
So that was a vicious comment.
It's been mean. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, you know, Andy Kelly really likes it still.
Yeah, it's true.
I get those people, but I know on Crank Crowbar Discord are playing it and enjoying it. Like, yeah. I imagine it's good, better with groups of friends. Like, I played it spottily on and off in multiplayer.
Yeah.
But I'm always hesitant at that because everything is better that way. Like, yeah. Literally everything. So,
yeah.
Don't know. What have you been playing, Tom?
I've played a trio of Warhammer games.
I'll just
rattle off. So it's just Tom Senior's Warhammer segment.
War hot takes.
War hot takes from the Warhammers. The first one is Last Stand mode has been updated with the Necron Overlord.
This is Dawn of War 2, right?
It's Dawn of War 2, Dawn of War Retribution. And it's the Last Stand mode. We've talked about it before on the podcast. I always rave about it. But it's a three player co-op mode in which you fight off hordes of enemies in an arena. Where it's pretty stupid, actually. Like, doors come down, and then orcs come out, and then you kill all the orcs, and then the doors come down again, and Eldar come out, and you kill all of them. But the best thing about it is the fact that you level up a hero over 20 levels, up unlocking a load of gear that can drastically change their role, and there's a lot of kind of fun theory crafting, and just a really fucking amazing sense of, you know, the skills are really fun to use, and the fantasy of the characters is really, really well understood and well executed, and the fiction is really good for horde mode stuff. So the Necron Overlord is, the Necrons are basically the undead of the far future grimdark setting that Games Workshop do. Don't ever say that to them because they're like, no, they're special, but no, they're just like saying
they're not robot skeletons. They are completely not robot skeletons in much the same way as the Eldar are not elves.
That's right.
And the orcs are, they are orcs.
They are orcs, yeah. Yeah. It's spelt with a K instead. So the the fluff of the Necrons is that...
the fluff of the Necrons. The downy fluff of the Necron Lord.
Yeah. The Necrons are basically invincible and were pretty much broken in Warhammer 40k for the tabletop game for a long time because if you just couldn't kill them, they'd just come back, keep on coming back. Relentless. And the idea is that they are underground everywhere.
So you're saying they struggle to die in some way, that they're undying?
Don't say it.
Okay.
Games Workshop won't be listening. They come back, they're everywhere, they're underground everywhere.
So they come out from under the ground.
And then, and whenever like a Necron Overlord stamps their staff in the ground, they claw out of the ground as though they were some kind of, you know.
Do you know what we often put as humans often put under the ground?
Yes, skeletons. I know. It's weird. Yeah, metals, high-tech metal skeletons. But somehow they're also incredibly technologically advanced. And there's a lot of kind of interesting stuff about around the fact that they can kind of launch metal scarabs at enemies, and they've got loads of nanobots that kind of eat people and things like this. And none of that is in the Necron Overlord character that I've experienced so far. So I've leveled up a few times with him, and he's just a massive, big old metal tank man. Who just stands there and takes damage.
Very shiny cape.
He's got a cape made out of metal, which is the most Warhammer 40k thing you can have. and he's got a big staff or a scythe if you choose to turn him into a close combat build. Though he's incredibly slow, so that's annoying. And he just tanks everything and occasionally lets loose a big blast from his old rod and wipes out a unit. And it's bizarre because all the other five or six heroes they've got are really varied and really interesting and great. And it's odd that after all this time, Relic has suddenly decided to update Last Stand after like they released the Tau Commander years ago, it feels like.
Literally years ago. That game's 5 years old.
Yeah. And suddenly this new character pops up who's kind of not that fun. But any excuse to go back into Last Stand is a good excuse, as far as I'm concerned, and everyone should play it. I think it's even available as a standalone game that I've done.
Did they call that Last Standalone?
They did call it that. They did.
Good for them. Good job.
Yeah, good job, Relic. So this is just basically, I'd probably say this every 6 months on the podcast, if you can get a couple of friends together, fucking play it. It's really fun. It's really, really good if you like that sort of thing.
And if you want to be a big, slow, not
stupid,
a skeleton.
Not a, yeah, if it's dead, but somehow.
You can summon death as well, which seems like,
yeah,
that seems like a bit of an on the nose.
Yeah, it's
sort of, we're not skeletons, honestly. Anyway, here's the Grim Reaper.
Yeah, literal Grim Reaper. There he is. Look at him. So that's really good. That's the first Warhammer game. The second one is Eternal Crusade, which is, went into a kind of Founders Program early access thing last June, I think, and is a 40k game.
It was relatively much more recently than that, wasn't it?
Was it?
It was this year.
I don't know. It feels like it's been around quietly for a while. I think they launched it quite early.
Okay, I think it was on Steam in January or something like that.
Yeah, maybe
February.
Maybe they released it a little too
early. Maybe I'm making this up.
It's kind of 15 on 15 large arena team multiplayer shooter in which you play as either Space Marines or Chaos Space Marines, and you shoot each other. And it's a bit kind of Planetside-y in that it's got vehicles. So there's a vehicle called the Rhino, which is basically a box that Space Marines go into and drives around. And it's class-based as well, and you unlock gear, and you can swap in, you know, customize your gear loadouts and all of that stuff. And it's kind of a really good fit for the fiction of the idea of being one of the models on the tabletop and fighting alongside your brothers for the Emperor and all that. But execution terms, like as a shooter, it's really, really, really awkward and really quite strange at the moment. And it is in early access, and they've got loads of development to go. But it's just stuff like, it's really ambiguous where bullets come from in your massive body. So you've got, it's a third person. So this is, you're a third person, and you've obviously got these massive, shoulder pads, and you're kind of huge on the screen. And when you're in third person, and you're to the side of the screen, you're shooting towards the center of the screen. There's a big ambiguity about what path your bullets are taking and when they're going to hit obstacles in between your player character and the target you're looking at. And for some reason, in Eternal Crusade at the moment, that's totally fucked. Like, there's something really deeply off about that. So you'll end up shooting stuff in between you and the enemy that you just don't understand where the bullets are coming from.
Space Marines tend to like hold their weapons at like crotch height.
They do, yeah. But like, I don't know where the logic of the game seems at odds with what should be happening according to what you're seeing on the screen in a very fundamental level. And weapons are also incredibly kind of inaccurate and kind of, unless you're like a sniper guy, and sometimes you kind of mow a guy down really quickly, sometimes you won't, and sometimes you just get nailed in the head really fast from an angle you don't anticipate, and it's really haphazard and just not there at all yet. And it's got a long way to go, even though it's the shell of it is good and it looks quite nice and aspects of it feel nice. There's definitely a lot of kind of game feel stuff and game logic stuff that still needs to be put in place to actually for it to grow into its potential.
I haven't played it yet, but I had those guys on the PC Gamer Weekend live stream.
Oh, yeah.
And they played through it, and they seemed nice, enthusiastic.
They are nice.
Dudes. The thing it reminded me of was Command & Conquer Renegade.
Oh, right.
I don't know if you ever played that.
No, I never played that.
The third-person Command & Conquer multiplayer shooter.
Oh, my. No, I never played that.
That game was probably great. I remember it being great, yeah. But I was like 15, so, you know, caveat there.
Yeah.
But it has that sort of like, it feels slightly ropey, or looks slightly ropey in a way that you would forgive, given how ambitious it was with the vehicles and the classes and stuff 10 years ago.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Where, like, it's not so unusual to have vehicles and classes and stuff in a game now.
Yeah.
So they do need to get that gun shooting on point.
It's tricky after playing. I've played a lot of Relics Space Marine, which is definitely like a 7 out of 10, 6
out of 10. That's a classic senior,
it's a classic top senior 6 out of 10 action game, yeah. Which has some stuff to recommend it, like the feel of squashing things in that game. Brilliant.
Just good squashing.
Good orc squashing, really violent, good kind of chain axe, chain sword stuff. It kind of suffered from just a kind of lack of scope, which is down to, I'm sure, a lack of budget and resources. Like, they couldn't make the huge battlefields with all the enemies that they obviously wanted to. But then, like, that had something that Eternal Crusade doesn't. And the gulf between those two, I know one is an online shooter, another one is not. But as we increasingly see, online shooters are more and more able to deliver good, crunchy kind of, the good, crunchy game feel that you'd associate with a single player game. They're getting better and better at it. And games like Eternal Crusade are going to have to do that as well if they're going to kind of knock around for longer.
That is the Division's problem as well. It's like, yeah, this is fine for an online game, but actually the fact that it's an online game, it's almost like that equation is flipped rather than forgiving something because it's also managing to pack loads of players into the arena.
Yeah.
It's now like, well, if this is an online RPG and you want me to spend hundreds of hours playing this, and like Eternal Crusade does the same thing because it has like the kind of global battle sort of MMO leveling thing. You're right, Tom.
Yeah, sorry, I'm going to have to adjust the mic. These mics are very keen today.
They are very keen.
There we go. Done.
We haven't tightened them sufficiently.
No,
it's now like, well, if you want me to treat this game like an actual hobby, then those fundamental shooting mechanics need to be fucking sharp as hell.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching you play Paragon before the pod started, And, you know, that's a intense, fast-paced online game, and it looks like it's very exciting. The skills going off look like they feel good, and they're big, impactful, flashy things.
You had a third Warhammer game, but we will talk about Paragon because I think that's really going to be really interesting.
We can segue into that. Yeah, let's do it. Let's talk about Paragon.
Okay, so we can return to the other place.
Grim, yeah, good.
So Paragon will be going into early access today when you're listening to this. If you listen to this on Friday, the 18th of March, it is Epic's MOBA, word I hate. But it is genuinely one of them. Like, it's a third-person game, Unreal Engine 4. It's very pretty, very Unreal Engine pretty, in that it's a world where men are cyborgs and some men are rhinos and women are women. And although actually it deserves some credit for having quite nicely balanced character design. Like, it's they've gone for that genre, but they're not selling individual characters, and they haven't been drawn into the into the titsy marketing loop that befalls a lot of games like this.
Yeah.
So I respect them for that. But it's a third person game, and because it's a third person game, you kind of expect it to be a shooter or to be a action game, and it has, big spectacular particle effects and stuff. But it really is a slow ass MOBA, that game.
Yeah.
It's like you move and shoot incredibly slowly. Relative to like how you look necessarily. And I really like it. I really like it because it feels different enough to Dota or any other game like that that I've played, because of the way its environment works. It's sort of truly three dimensional landscape. Smite is a third person MOBA, but it takes place on a 2D plane, where there's cover, but there's everyone's on a level, whereas this is meaningfully vertical, in some interesting ways. And it has a bunch of new ideas and original things that it does with how XP works and cards and all this stuff that we could get into. But the point is really the sort of the strategy stuff is still familiarly Dota, which is really nice. So you end up in this sort of, for me, it's a really interesting balance where it feels a lot like a game that I know enough that I can sort of deploy a whole bunch of, stuff that I've internalized strategically over years of playing these games, but it's a genuinely new thing at the same time, and it rewards strategies that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do elsewhere. Like, it allows, like, the way high ground works. Like, in Dota, for example, high ground is a really hard rule. If you are attacking uphill, you have a certain chance that your attack will just miss, and you can see downhill and you can't see uphill, and those are all, like, hard fog of war rules. Because it literally is uphill in Paragon and not just like moving between two planes on an isometric field, they can, it feels the boundaries of that system are a lot fuzzier. Some of the same things are true, like it's easier to defend high ground than it is to attack up high ground, but they're true for like more interesting reasons. Mm-hmm. Like, and a defender on the top of a ridge line can get better information because they can peek over the top and see things more easily. They can peek and fire abilities down. Some ultimates have the character might leap into the air and then smash to the ground, and it makes a difference. Like, takes longer to land if you jump from on high, but you have more time to aim it as you're coming down, that kind of thing. So
interesting.
Like, there's a lot of meaningful reasons to use the terrain, but all that stuff folds into a game that's kind of familiar. And I'll be really interested to see what people make of it. Because one thing is they are releasing it into early access alpha, and it's really early. Like, they're not fucking around. Like, this isn't a test the servers before we press go, which is kind of what Overwatch is at the moment.
Right.
Actually, they are meaningfully patching Overwatch as well, but that's more like balance tweaks. We'll add some things, we'll fiddle with some things. Whereas this is like, game is not done yet. Like, whole massive parts of the UI are totally rudimentary. Characters, there are characters that don't have animations for running and shooting at the same time. So, like, I know you saw me play a bit earlier. The character I was playing there, if you start shooting while you're running with her, she starts to slide because her legs don't have animations for when she's running and shooting at the same time. So it's that early. Like, the game is playable, perfectly playable, but it's like mega rough. So that's part one. Part two is that it is extremely slow. And if you don't necessarily have the training in that genre to understand the drama of two people trying to shoot each other across a wave of little robots that are fighting, and what that means strategically, and like the skill involved in maybe getting a kill from that position by knocking someone down, or, cleverly using your abilities to create a no-win situation for them from a neutral situation, then I think its excitement might be lost on you. Like, it was interesting that you saw it and thought, wow, that looks really kind of kinetic and impactful.
Yeah.
Cause it is spectacular. But I think if you don't know what you're achieving, it's not necessarily not what you're doing, but if you aren't capable of passing that chaos to perceive the effect of the thing you've done,
yeah,
then a lot of that satisfaction is lost. Like that is such it's a much easier thing to do in a shooter where everyone understands the relationship between bullet and face. Whereas in this, like, you know, we had a huge team fight, I think you saw, and there was a moment where I jumped into it with a character who could jetpack, and then realized as I was jetpacking that there was an enemy who'd kind of like leapt away from the battle underneath me. So as I was going over, they were coming back through, and I managed to sort of spin in 360 degrees in midair and like throw my massive stun orb backwards so it hit them in the head. And it looked kind of sick, but if you don't kind of understand what the fuck just happened, then it's not the same sort of like impactful shooteriness that you would get from headshotting somebody.
Right.
Or like, you know, nailing a grenade or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But I like it. Like, I think they've done a really good job of, it's not balanced yet, but the rhythm of the game feels really nice. Like, I think you were kind of lucky. The game you saw, I was matched with somebody who knew the game quite well and sort of had the same opinions on it that I do,
right,
in terms of like how you win. And so the point where we kind of pressed our advantage to the point where we could win, we then withdrew and then sort of took over strategic parts of the map. Because again, the map is really complicated. It's satisfying to just move around and plan ambushes and stuff. And then you kind of move into the phase where it feels like a more interesting version of sieging. And all these games are ultimately about sieging an ancient of some kind. Then sort of sometimes Dota devolves into, like, rather than just trying to get a big enough advantage so you can brute force one doorway, it's always kind of tempting to try and like withdraw into the jungle and the kind of winding pathways surrounding each base and then plan an ambush and then build your victory on there. But yeah, hard game not to kind of end up monologuing about, because it is just sort of, it's interesting to me that Epic have chosen to make a kind of a MOBA player's MOBA. It's not, I don't think, a very good entry point to that genre yet.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's, well, not only because it's early, but and because it doesn't have a new player experience, but because it's fiddly and sort of technical.
Yeah.
And I think when you start playing it, you'd be like, why the hell? Like, when I fire my gun, a little timer appears that says I can fire my gun again in a second and a half, which is it's a fucking eon in most shooter terms.
It seems to have a very complicated card-based kind of skill tweaking system in the game and stuff.
Yeah.
In the middle of between rounds or whatever.
The card system is clever. Like, that might be an area where they might have overcomplicated things for no apparent reason in the pursuit of simplifying things, but we'll see. Like, at the moment, it's not helped by the fact that that's the area where the UI is absolutely fucking placeholder for everything. Right. The art is placeholder. Yeah, the menus are placeholder. But the idea is that instead of getting gold and spending it on items to upgrade your character, you get card points, which you spend on cards that you draw from a deck that you construct in advance of the game on a character-by-character basis. And then different characters have affinities with different suits of cards.
Oh, God.
So they can load different things into their decks. And the decks affect what upgrades, passives, and actives you pull during a game that you then buy with your card points.
Yeah.
And that allows you to steer your character meaningfully in different ways during the course of a single game. So you might go, this game makes sense for me to go all health bonuses. This game makes sense for me to go cooldown reduction. But all of those things exist in Dota or League, where you have an item store with hundreds of items and you can buy any of them.
Yeah.
The good thing about this is it means there's no wrong decisions, because you can only bring cards that are appropriate to the character you've got with you. So you can't be like fucking about in the shop and buy the wrong thing. So that's good.
I see.
But it does mean that you're making a lot of sort of theory crafty decisions that might turn out to not be relevant at all. But I need to play it more, and I think I need them to finish the system. I need them to finish making it before I can tell whether it's actually a good idea. It sounds like they've got a clever idea for what it should be.
Yeah.
But
it's interesting that they've, between this and Unreal Tournament, they've really, really gone for getting their games out, these games out very, very early and getting the community in very early, which probably seems like a good idea to me, with especially on games like this, which require a lot of balancing, a lot of kind of careful work before they're presented as a competitive thing you might want to get into.
That's something that's actually, I think, quite attractive about Paragon at the moment, is it feels like you're kind of on the ground floor. Like, there are only 13 characters in it at the moment. You know, Dota's on 107. I don't know where League is. It's in the getting towards 100, I think.
Yeah.
Like, that, it feels like, you know, this is the chance to be the person that can, if the game is successful, the person that looks back and says, oh man, I was playing this when 80 of these characters weren't in the game.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is attractive if you came to Dota more than a decade after it was a thing, because, you know, you hear those stories. But, and yeah, and like, you know, I've met the developers and they seem very, you know, earnest about making this game, which is interesting because it's actually most of the Gears of War team.
Oh, right.
Like a lot of the, like the, I know the creative lead, Steve Superville was, I think, the lead programmer on the entire Gears of War series, which is a really interesting shift for those developers from, and, you know, apparently it's the old story of we were playing a lot of Dota in the office. So we're making this now. Which is exactly why Valve bought Dota. Like the TF2 team were playing a lot of Warcraft 3 mods and they were like, hang on.
Wait a minute.
Can we own this? I'd like to buy this, please.
It's the classic. Valve love a good mod they can possibly own.
Yeah, they do.
Very good at that.
Yeah.
Very good at that.
But like, nonetheless, right? Like, it feels like a lot of companies have done that, but this is the interesting answer to the question, what if the Gears of War team decided to make Dota? And it is in some ways the game you'd expect them to make in that it has big rhino men and robots and stuff. And otherwise not, because it has, you know, it's there's no blood in it and it's very cerebral and slow. And like, which is...
I'm glad I know that, because that's going to add an extra kind of layer to it. I'll try it at some point when it's further down the line, probably like 6 months. And, but yeah, I'll enjoy seeing if I could see any Gears kind of Gearsy. It looks kind of epic, like an epic thing, but less bulky. And
so I think that for me, it really feels like it's set inside like an Unreal tech demo.
Right. Okay.
Because I don't think, because they haven't necessarily like said much about what the story of the world is, or like why those characters are there fighting, like the map is these like sort of like sci-fi ancient techno overgrown ruined temple things.
Right.
So, and you know how like every single like 3D Mark demo, Unreal Engine tournament demo, the benchmarking tool you got with your Voodoo graphics card is always set in a sci-fi temple of some kind. It's always like laser Egyptians, right? Every single fucking
time. It's always Unreal. The first Unreal had loads of lovely sci-fi temples.
Yeah, exactly. It's set in that world.
Okay.
And like some of the people are, you know, there's like the worst character designer in it is a guy called Twin Blast, who is just a fucking man. With some guns.
Right.
Like, it's some guns, man. And I hope they release some exciting skins, because like, one of the other characters is like a raccoon in a mech.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
They're sort of like, they kind of lost it with like some guns, man. There's an archer lady who is just Katniss Everdeen.
Right.
Which is cool. Like, it's nice that they go for that archetype rather than any of the other archetypes they could go for. But, you know, Katniss Everdeen. And, there's like two different big grey Hulk kind of characters. There's
the lizardy guy with swords.
That's one of the two. There's Rhino with swords.
Okay.
But yeah, you can imagine them fighting in a dynamically collapsing physics environment. In order to show off the latest sort of middleware that, that they've produced. Actually, I do think it looks really nice, actually. Yeah, it's very readable. Which is cool. Given how sort of visually noisy it is. But yeah, I think it doesn't necessarily have like immediate world selling personality in the way that Overwatch does, for example, where you can imagine how all those characters fit into their world and that even the maps tell something of a story. Like,
I think Blizzard have just today announced some of the comics and little kind of animated shorts they're going to be releasing alongside Overwatch, which is always the plan. It was going to be a whole kind of web of a multimedia web of, you know, really charming Saturday morning cartoon stuff.
It occurred to me with that stuff that they're actually going up against Valve and the TF2 comics.
Because
the TF2 comics are like actually one of the best things so Valve has ever done.
They're amazing. They're amazing. I love them.
Like, and the TF2 shorts as well.
Yeah.
Like, it hadn't occurred to me, because I was like, oh yeah, Blizzard do cinematics. But actually, like, their competition on that is really stiff. Like, Blizzard have done really high quality cinematics, but they've never been that funny or clever ever.
The Axe comic was brilliant, I thought.
That's true, yeah. Valve's comics are always great.
Like, yeah, they are.
They have some very funny writers for some reason.
It's really true.
For a company great that doesn't communicate very much. They put out some top-tier comics.
Love them.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the TF2 comics are genuinely worth reading, even if you never play or plan to play TF2, because they are hilarious. And, you know, clever. And I'd be amazed if Overwatch gets anywhere near that, really, given, you know, Blizzard aren't bad storytellers by any means, but they are not that type of storyteller. They are... You'll wear this to a convention, big chunky storytelling that everyone can get into. Whereas Valve is just sort of like weird, anarchic kind of comedy cartoons.
They've got an amazing knack for generating meme-like, kind of quirky meme-like, easily. You buy into Valve stuff in a way that's quite feels quite in-jokey, even though everyone who reads a Valve comic gets it.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. They have a knack for making everyone feel like the joke is something they particularly kind of came up with.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, that's good. So, Paragon, don't play it yet then, I guess?
The thing is, like, everyone in the universe is going to be streaming it. Because they are not dumb, so they're going to put a huge amount of resources into getting people to stream it, I imagine.
Yeah, sure.
So I would say watch some streams and see if it's for you, if you already like that kind of game.
Mm.
For me, it feels more like a kind of a curio for people who are really into that genre that might become something really exciting with time. And I know people who listen to this either are in that position where they're interested and probably jump on board and enjoy it, or they have already checked out of this conversation because they hate that genre so much. You had a remaining Warhammer game.
Yeah, briefly. I for the first time played Total War Warhammer at the PC Gamer Weekender.
Total War Warhammer.
And it was very entertaining, and I would be very interested to see if they get a new audience for Total War that was previously put off by the so-called, what they might perceive to be, fusty historical settings.
Mm.
I think it could change a lot of people's minds when you put a giant spider in it. A giant spider the size of a double-decker bus ridden by a load of goblins. And I was playing with some dwarves, and it was kind of like a pre-designed scenario, and it's all set underground. And throughout the scenario, the besieged dwarven armies attacked from various angles by orcs and goblins. And I put it on hard mode because if you won on hard mode, you got a t-shirt that I would never have worn. But the principle of the thing meant that
some future laundry day will thank you.
Yes. And so I thought, I'm going to win this. I'm going to get that t-shirt. And it was really fun and really challenging in a way that I wasn't expecting as well. So
but you've played a lot of Total War. I have played a lot. Why was this specifically challenging?
I think it's because in historical settings, hero units, like the really big units, don't necessarily look like the really big units that they are. So it was in Medieval 2, like a big old fucking unit of knights, you knew instinctively what that was going to do. But in like Empire Total War, who knows, these red jersey dudes are going to do more damage in this scenario than these other red jersey dudes over here, or these guys in blue jerseys over here. And just having the fantasy setting just exposes how powerful things are and what they can do in a much more effective way than a historical setting ever could. So you know that the giant spider thing, you know that you don't want to be getting close to that thing. You don't want to be doing that, you know, getting up in its grill, because it's going to fucking eat you. And it's just really clear what everything does. And really satisfying to kind of manipulate that and, you know, focus fire all of your flame cannons on the giant spider as it's slowly charging in on your units. And then you see it kind of its nerve breaks. I don't know if a spider has a nerve that can break, but this one has morale.
They do run away in real life. So
they do, that's true, yeah. So he doesn't fancy it because he's on fire and he starts running away. the dwarven general is being carried by four smaller dwarves on a throne, and he's got a giant book of grudges in front of him.
Mm.
And he waves his axe and he shouts grudges and he writes down grudges, and he's just, you know, he never forgets. So the image of zooming in and watching him just kind of wave his axe at this enormous spider that's coming towards him as all of his artillery just bombard the spider, and the spider is almost about to just fucking eat him, and then the spider just like turns around and runs away again. And it's just really funny and really silly, but also I think like the setting far, far more clearly expresses the rules of the game, because Total War is still quite bloated in many ways, specifically like individual units. They have like 20 characteristics for like charge power, or, you know, charge defense, like general kind of toughness, attack, morale. There's just loads and loads of different components to a unit, and it's very, very difficult to understand what units are good at and what they're bad at a glance. And hopefully Total War Warhammer will be able to do that much more efficiently than its historical counterparts, where those differences are much more nuanced and kind of gritty in a way that is quite inaccessible unless you've played loads of them.
Because I was locked in my streaming box for a lot of the weekender, I didn't play it, but I did speak to the lead battle designer.
Mm.
And something he said that actually I thought was really fun, I was going to ask if you hit this, was that when they were designing the mission environments of the underground dwarf stuff, stuff about the dwarf army started to make more sense. That because they're not very fast, they don't have cavalry. but they have really big guns, the perfect environment for them is a funnel.
Hmm.
Like, it's a funnel where the enemy has to come at them from one direction. And so, like, even though I don't think even the tabletop game is designed to tell this story, like, the way the units the dwarves bring, like huge cannon lines and stuff like that, and sort of sturdy infantry, make loads of sense in the environment that they actually occupy. Because, yeah, you want to just fire big guns at the thing that's running at you down the big rectangular corridor. And obviously you don't want to get flanked. And so, yeah, they're very different as a field army because they're not really designed for that. But I really like the idea that Total War can break out of being a game about relatively matched, grounded modern armies meeting on a traditional field of battle and sort of explain why, like, dwarves are this ridiculous technology faction and all their technology is designed to win battles in tunnels. And this is why. Mm. And but it actually works mechanically. So I don't know if you found that when you were defending your tunnels that...
Yeah, that was interesting. They're definitely nailed the artillery characteristics of dwarves in that they're good at artillery, but not necessarily long range artillery. Because as you say, again, you don't need long range artillery in an underground environment. So they're very good at flame cannons that can blast something 20 meters away and horribly massacre it. But they're not going to have like rock lobbers that are going to sit out, you know, pretty at the back of a field of battle or on a hill somewhere. And that does like the armies have very, very good, like, vivid personalities. And that apparently will translate to the campaign map as well. So, vampire counts.
You are allowed to say that vampire counts are undead, aren't you?
You are allowed to say that, yeah. The undead vampire counts. They spread their, their corruption, whatever it is. I don't know. And that allows them to, you know, raise troops in places they couldn't otherwise raise troops. And the other thing is magic as well. Magic is also very, very funny. Addition to a Total War. There's, you know, whilst fighting the orcs and goblins, an evil green moon would just appear hovering above the battlefield, and it moves at random directions, which is very true to the tabletop game as well. So if you cast it too close to your own troops, it can suck people into it. And
the moon sucks people in.
The moon sucks people in, zaps them. It's a big old green moon, and the AI cast it right in the middle of my kind of flame cannons and just sucked all the tiny little, very panicked dwarves up into it. And that was the end of my flame cannons. And it was good. It's full of little anecdotes like that. It's really nice. I like it. It's playing really, really well. I'm really, really, really excited about it.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Given how excited I was for Rome 2 and how little I ended up playing that game, how excited I was for it.
I think the thing with Rome 2 I found actually afterwards, after bombing it for many, many hours review and then doing another campaign afterwards, was that it's such an undertaking. It's like Empire was back in the day, like the big sandbox Total Wars, the truly huge sandboxes. It's like, oh God, this is weeks of stuff I'm getting into, and it's hours and hours and hours. And I'm hoping that the fantasy setting would be a bit more brisk, a bit more fun.
Mm. Yeah. And a bit more directed. Like you want to start again. Not out of like, I wonder if it's going to be different if I'm Persia, but like, I actually want to see, you know, what it's like to play as the dwarves and have to, like, you know, that Book of Grudges is a dynamic campaign system.
Yeah.
So the dwarves remember and they have to get revenge for slights. Otherwise they face civil unrest because the Book of Grudges is getting too big.
I love that stuff.
Yeah. It's nerdy, but it's good.
It's good. It's good.
But yeah, it just goes to show liberating your game from the strictures of real life or history and just fucking putting orcs in it.
Yeah.
It's a solution to any game design problem.
No one wants Tom Clancy's Total War Warhammer.
No. Tom Clancy's Warhammer.
God.
Shall we do questions from questions?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Now, I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, so I apologize in advance. Cabra writes, will Tom Sr. suffer podcast burnout now that he's on the PC Gamer podcast? Also, when is Half-Life 3 coming out?
To both questions, never.
We should probably clarify. So the PC Gamer podcast is actually back, which is simply because circumstances allow it now, and PC Gamer team has changed substantially since the old days.
Yeah.
So editor Sam Roberts wants to...
Do some chats.
So the chats will happen. Won't impact on us doing Crate and Crowbar at all. I will be on both. Tom Sr. will be on both.
We've got enough hot takes to go around, don't we, Chris?
Yeah.
More than enough.
I mean, and also, to be fair, the PC Gamer team is mostly people who aren't on this podcast.
Yeah.
So you'll get to hear from a lot of different voices as well. So, yeah. So I think we'll both do it on and off.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. Both things can coexist. CNC will still happen.
It'll be fun.
Andre writes, With EverQuest Next being cancelled, what do you think is going to happen to the MMO? Will it be soft MMOs like The Division, or more traditional MMOs like World of Warcraft? Or will the genre go into a completely different direction? Thanks.
I think after the apparent financial success of The Division, every company is going to want one, their own one of them. And I'd be interested to see what EA's is. And I think that Titanfall might be an interesting fit.
As oh, no.
Yep.
Do you reckon
could happen? I know. I love Titanfall so much. And they're definitely working on Titanfall 2. Maybe it, I mean, it seems a bit late to course correct if they weren't already making it that way. So it could just be another good shooter.
I hope that's not true. I want just Titanfall again, and for this time it to work for some reason.
Yeah, for people to keep playing it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, I think more broadly, like, the MMO question is, I think, you know, I'm wary of saying subscription MMOs are dead, because I've been saying that for 4 years.
Eve's still going, WoW's still going.
Yeah.
Tor is going.
But there aren't any new ones that have been successful. No, so that's
no,
the thing.
No, that's true.
They can't breed anymore.
No.
Okay.
Pandas.
Like pandas. Yeah. And so it depends what it really means. Like, network technology is to the point now where it doesn't mean a lot for a game to have a lot of players in it or to connect a lot of different people. And so the question of whether you even need the name MMO is sort of, it's becoming increasingly irrelevant, I think.
Yeah.
Like, once upon a time, you would pay a subscription fee because the network technology required to make the game happen was advanced and expensive, and that simply isn't the case anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, you know, if a game wants to have a networking system that matches thousands and hundreds of thousands of players together, then that'll happen. So maybe it's simply not becoming a, maybe it's simply not a useful definition anymore. I think the notion of a persistent world is still a useful idea that is becoming increasingly rare as things become sort of siloed off, heavily instanced, kind of curated experiences rather than big worlds that everybody occupies. Eve is still around and isn't going anywhere, so I don't know. But yeah, whether or not we'll see another one of them is a more interesting question, and honestly a question that I think the industry's been asking for like 10 years now.
Yeah.
So the answer is probably at this point no. But who knows?
I'm looking forward to seeing new ways of integrating online. It's getting, the lines are blurring more and more between single player and multiplayer. And, you know, when you're in an instance and when you're in a hub, and that's, increasingly kind of, there's a lot of kind of gray areas. Like, The Division shows, like, sometimes you will see other people as you're kind of wandering around the world. You can't really do anything with them, but I think you do sometimes see people in the streets. And then if you go into a mission, it'll be instanced. And then you go into the dark zone, suddenly it's a PvP thing. And I'm looking forward to games experimenting more with that kind of ambiguity of space and not knowing whether that figure on the horizon is a real human being or an NPC or who knows what.
Yeah. Passively multiplayer.
Yeah. Nice.
Nice. Zed writes, sorry, powering through these, we've got quite a lot. So, every multiplayer game seems to go through a process where eventually only really committed players remain, making it impossible for new players to join a few months after release. How can games address this, and which games do it well? Guild Wars 2 does this well.
Oh, yes. And almost no other game does this well.
You were saying, I think, recently, I don't remember, were you saying this on the... in the office, on the internet, which way I hear your thoughts about things, I this thought you had.
I've been honking it out in various multimedia formats. But yeah, my frustration at people, friends of different levels being unable to co-op with each other in games where loot is instanced. And this is true of Diablo 3 and The Division. There's absolutely no reason why you can't solve this in the same way that Guild Wars 2 did, by down-leveling the higher level person into low. Like, it makes sense that the lower level player can't play a higher level mission, but if a high level player wants to come down and play a low level mission with their friend, then why not just instance the loot so they still get nice stuff, but then down level them so that they're still kind of the same level as the challenge? I mean, it just seems, why not do it?
Guild Wars does it, Destiny does it.
Yeah, Destiny does it well.
And it's perfect in both cases. Like, it means that the high level player has to move at the pace of the lower level player, but that's fine. Because if you've just gotten your friend into a game and you want to level with them,
Show up them a little bit.
You should show up with them, yeah. And like, it doesn't cost you anything as a developer to have the higher level player get rewards that are appropriate pretty much for their level. Maybe not the best possible things they could get.
Yeah.
But like, give them useful stuff, crafting materials and resources, and a chance to get the really good stuff they want at that level.
Yeah.
Like, other games have done it, and yeah, the fact that Division doesn't, I think, is a real bad.
It is a bad. I mean, I was trying to play with Phil Savage, and he was level 4, I was up to level 15, and it was, I went in there and we tried hard mode because we wanted to do that kind of level things out, but no, it levels everyone up to the highest level player and then adds some extra difficulty on top for there being an extra player involved. And then I went down to his, level 4, and it was just trivially easy. So I stretched my pistol to try and make it more leveled. And, you know, at that point, the game should just do that for you.
Yeah, it should just scale your damage.
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
build with that in mind. Like, sure. I feel like for now, it's just, like, that's an unforgivable failure now. Like,
yeah, definitely.
Games have solved it so completely.
Yeah.
That there's no reason to have a scenario where you just can't play together because the other person has to play 10 hours.
It's such
you don't play in that time.
It's such a co-op-focused game as well. It's the same with Diablo. Like, Diablo 3 has this problem where, you know, I can't go in and play with my mate unless I roll an alt. And rolling an alt is easy in Diablo, but when all the loot is instant and appears differently for everyone, then I don't see what the problem is.
Because we had that magic first run through where...
We
did it all together.
Yeah,
me and Tom Hatfield.
Yeah. That's great.
It was great. And then like you and I did like the third run together. Cause we both independently then did a second
That's
run.
Right. Yeah.
But it only works if that kind of like that, you know, with that sort of fortuitous sort of timing.
Yeah.
Like some of my best experiences in Destiny have been helping lower level friends through stuff that I've done.
Mm.
But it's not like there are two ways that high level players can interact with lower level players. They either kill everything for them, in which case no one's having fun because the higher level player isn't challenged and the lower level player doesn't get to play the game. Or they bestow expertise. And bestowing expertise is amazing.
Like, yeah,
it's the brilliant thing about Destiny's raids that I don't know how the Division is going to do this within the confines of their fiction, where Destiny's raids are these sort of like arcane combat puzzles where the first time you go into those environments, you'll have no idea how to succeed because the rules of the environment will have changed completely in some sort of high concept sci-fi way. And so not only is that really satisfying to learn the first time, but it means if you go back to play with a friend, you get to act as kind of like this mentor.
Yeah.
You can either lead them to find the truth themselves or you can just explain it to them. Like, hey, in this room, we've got to do this, this, and this, or we're going to get deleted from time and that kind of thing. And that's fun. Like, that's a fun way of interacting with a friend who's new to the game because you get to show off a bit. But when it comes to the actual combat, you've still got to hold your own. That's They've still got to hold their own.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, like, I don't know. There's no excuse for just having it be like high-level person can one-shot a fireman. Like, especially, yeah. It's like, if you're level 15, your level 15 AK-47 does, I don't know, 6 times more damage than their level 4 AK-47, even though it's the same gun in the same world shooting the same people.
Right, right.
Like, more ways in which this would be better with orcs.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a no-brainer. It really frustrates me when I see it.
Makes Tom Cross stop doing it. Ruben writes, and this is more of a response to a previous comment on the podcast rather than a question, but I'll get through it. Hello, Craven Cronenbergs. I'll try to keep this brief, but it's kind of crazy. Crazy. Just thought I'd give a heads up to Tom Francis that the infinitely large game he described in episode 130, where you beat a level and the level becomes the thing you then play inside and another level, basically already exists and more in the form of Inside a Starfield Sky, a top-down twin-stick shooter by Jason Rohrer. Each level in the game takes place inside the little procedurally generated blob creature you play in the next level, and the level transition is simply zooming out until the level becomes your playable character inside another larger entity.
Holy
when
shit.
You die, you zoom back in. An additional mechanic that really captures a sense of scale and the infinite is that you can, at a button press, zoom inside any enemy or power-up in the game and play that as a level for the lone purpose of either upgrading that power-up or weakening that enemy. Any power-ups you collect inside of a power-up power up that power-up.
Holy shit, that's awesome.
And any power-ups you collect inside of an enemy give that enemy that power-up. So you try to pick up the bad power-ups in that case.
Yeah.
You zoom back out by completing the level, leaving you where you were when you zoomed in. While inside of an enemy or power-up, you can further zoom into an enemy or power-up again. And likewise, if you die, you zoom into yourself inside that enemy power-up or power-up. You can see where this is going.
Yes.
Which is really hard to say after this much Malo. The game gives a unique sense of nostalgia in a way, where you get lost in a maze of zooming failures and attempts to get stronger power-ups or weaker enemies, before pulling through and finding yourself back where you were, face-to-face with that one crazy strong enemy you were trying to weaken for the last 20 minutes. I hate to pull an Inception reference, but I imagine it's how those two characters felt after being lost in limbo for decades, completely forgetting the real world, and then finding themselves once again in a higher layer of reality. Thanks for podding along, Ruben. That sounds a fucking amazing. Yeah,
gonna play that. Man, that sounds awesome. Sounds great.
Yeah, so, yeah, apparently game Tom F. hypothesized is real. So
maybe that's our reality now, that, like, Inception, when Tom dreams it, it just kind of becomes a game in the past.
Also, hang on, we are in the reality where Tom... What?
This is definitely, after this much red wine, it's not the rude road we should be.
Okay, let's move on really quickly. Jamie writes, "Dear Crack and Cocaine."
Nice.
"Recently, I watched an Awesome Games Done Quick speedrun of The Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion, which made use of Cyrodiil's favourite recreational drug, Skooma, to boost movement speed and carry capacity. I began to consider how Bethesda games have dabbled with simulating addiction in the past, and what an interesting sandbox for exploring addiction an open-world RPG has the potential to be. Imagine having a growing dependency that results in blackouts and a recurring quest to get your fix, with consequences that make all other activity fall by the wayside. Anyway, my question to you would be, what games have excelled at exploring addiction or other mental and physical afflictions through mechanics as opposed to narrative? How would you like to see issues like this tackled in the future? Look forward to hearing you. I've been a loyal listener since episode one. Your chats always brighten up my day. Lots of love and best wishes to Marsh and Graham on their adventures, and I'm sure Pip will make an excellent addition to the team. Thanks for reading, everybody. Jamie from Glasgow." Sorry for fucking your name up there for no reason. Survival games, basically this, the game, comes to mind.
Okay.
Like, you need a thing really badly, or it's going
to
end.
You'll do anything to get it.
So, yeah, go kill the man for a tin of beans in DayZ or something like that.
Yeah, it's interesting, the Skooma addiction in Oblivion and the subsequent kind of drug addictions that exist in Elder Scrolls games, because they're just kind of a minor debuff, aren't they? They just kind of vaguely affect your...
You're feeling a bit peaky.
Yeah, and it feels like, as Jamie suggests, like, it feels like a drug addiction as a mechanic should fundamentally change your behavior. It should re-incentivize your entire, approach to the game. It should, and to that extent, probably the better version of drug addiction in the Elder Scrolls universe is vampirism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, does completely changes the way you look at the world and the way that you walk around it. Obviously, like, can you go outside in the daylight?
You take damage over time. Okay. In sunlight.
And then, I think you have to drink blood as well.
You do.
To stay alive or to get buffs and things. And also, it can be cured, and it's a big, long, difficult process to cure it. It's a whole quest line, isn't there, where you have
and
to...
And, like, civilians hate you and stuff like that, yeah.
So it's probably better than the Skooma addiction. It's a bit closer than... It's their being proper heroin addiction, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it can sort of just happen to you as well, whereas, like, yeah, you meet... Like, I mean, my Oblivion playthrough, my first one, which I invested in super heavily because I love that game, was defined by vampirism, because I was playing it completely as a good guy, and there's a quest you get as part of... I can spoil Oblivion things 10 years after the fact.
That's allowed, yeah.
Yeah. Christ, 10 years. That game came out in 2006. It's 2016.
I hit the wine.
I was going to stop for a drink. Hang on. Oh, God.
Fuck you, Father Time.
Skyrim's 5 years old this year.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Damn.
Oh, Jesus.
It's going to be okay.
That's right. We're all going to be time skeletons. It's cool. Robot time skeletons.
Okay, Necrons one day.
Yeah, exactly. So while doing the arena quest line, where you kind of fight through the arena to become the arena champion, the last, I think the I've forgotten what they're called, like the Grey Champion or something, is actually a vampire. And they send you, I think, to kill the person that vampirized them. And I got vampirized by that person completely by chance in that fight with the vampire. And it felt like such a good story beat. I let it happen. Like, I could have loaded a save, but I didn't. And this happened to have occurred at the point in the story where Sean Bean has sort of listlessly phoned it in enough to send you off to find a Daedric artifact and return with one. And so it's a sort of open-ended part of the story where you could just go off and find the first Daedric artifact you can get and come back with it, or you can take much longer. And I ended up spending like months of in-game time as a vampire. Like, I used my sudden vampirism as an excuse to do all the evil content, like Dark Brotherhood and stuff. But actually, even that happened by accident because I killed someone while feeding.
Yeah.
And like, suddenly I've sort of had this massive arc where it's like my character has gone from being this emerging hero to the dark years.
90s comics phase for your character.
It was, yeah. Yeah, I went full Todd McFarlane.
Nice.
And then got really, really powerful and eventually cured my vampirism, found a Daedric artifact, one of the several I had from years as an evil person.
Right.
And, you know, returned sheepishly to the temple. What was that like 6 months later in Oblivion time? And I really liked that was kind of like this little episode that happened in the middle of my Oblivion playthrough that wouldn't necessarily happen for any other player, but kind of completely fit the story for me, where like the blades are like, oh, well, that guy's probably just fucking gone.
Yeah.
And then like 6 months later, he shows up again. Like, well, what happened to you? Like, don't ask.
So some shit happened.
I went through some shit.
1,000-yard stare.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I had to go to vampire rehab, but I'm back now.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, also the other thing would be that I think the Elder Scrolls games and the Fallout games in particular, because of their tool sets, I know that there are amazing mods for like hunger and thirst. I don't know if there are any good like Skoomer addiction mods or anything like that. But plenty of people have done work to make things like, you know, freezing to death a thing, and to make those games much harsher in terms of survival mechanics. So I imagine those, to be honest, I think those games are probably still your best bet if you're looking for games that explore addiction. Like,
I'm not sure any others.
I can't really think of very many others that kind of just
mechanically,
it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's something where the Dragon Age series really falls down because it tells you again and again and again that like Lyrium is addictive.
Oh, yeah.
But you fucking neck it
all
down,
the time.
Neck
yeah.
it all the time without consequence.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
But because of the open-ended nature of the Elder Scrolls series and Fallout as well, for that matter, I think those games are closer to it, and then their communities have made them better at it generally.
Yeah, interesting question.
Good question, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kane writes, "Ho." He says that as greeting.
Ho.
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 I, like the other 7 billion real humans on this void sphere, have played a bit of Stardew Valley. You remember Stardew Valley? You talked about it earlier this very episode, which is a good gambit, Kane.
Yeah,
but
it's
wrong,
a good
in
guess.
This case. We only talked about Warhammer and The Division and Paragon. When you give villagers gifts in that game, they have a set number of responses based on whether it's their birthday and how much they like the gift. For the latter, all gifts are divided up into 5 discrete categories, from loved through to hated. So if you give someone 2 different gifts that fall into the like category, you'll get the same response. So, for instance, if you give Abigail an apple, which she likes, she'll say this, and they sent a screenshot of her saying, "Hey, how'd you know I was hungry? This looks delicious." If instead you give her a recently mined quartz deposit or emerald, which she also likes, she'll say this, another screenshot, in which she says, "Hey, how'd you know I was hungry? This looks delicious."
Tasty
which
emeralds.
Leads me to my question. Which crystal or gem do you find most delicious? And what sort of meal do you like it in? Also, what's the most amusing stock NPC dialogue response you've seen in a game, but mostly the first question?
Been playing a lot of Damwell, and that's got lovely explodey gems. And they're...
Would you eat them?
I kind of do want to eat them. There's some gems, actually. Destiny's another one. I want to eat those engrams. Or I want to do something to those engrams. I don't know what they're just fucking
I want to both stack them and put them in my mouth.
Yeah, man.
Those it's like toddler amazing. Instinct of like, yeah, this is fucking going in my mouth.
They've tapped into something there with those engrams. Because I think you said before about just kind of staring at them and just being like, look,
they're beautiful.
It's like, look at how they move inside and stuff.
There's like light in there.
Yeah.
I want to eat all of the bejeweled gems. I want to actually just start one of those cascades and just like... let it fall in my mouth.
Oh, yeah.
So take a break from the pot now to just eat some Lego. That'd be good.
Tasty.
In terms of amusing stock NPC dialogue response, I actually, not to return to The Division again, but that game, in addition to its other things, has some fucking classic Clancy-verse NPC shouty bollocks.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the spirit of Fisher in the Airfield, an ongoing radio play between two men shouting in the dark.
Yeah, yeah.
and the man in the leather pants.
It's Fisher. Fisher's over there. Fisher. Yeah.
They've really tried with the NPC box for the Division. Which is, again, one of those things that makes that weird subtext that you're just fucking gunning people down in the street that are otherwise regular people, even weirder. But they've done this thing where occasionally, there's one shot you hear all the time, which is, it will be like, cause they try and do that aggressive thing of like, we've got to make people feel like bad guys. So they'll be like, we're going to kill the bitch, kill him, shoot him with the guns. But then one of the things they'll shout is, oh my God, they're killing us. Which is actually, again, harrowing. A bit on the nose for like how harrowing it is. Like, I'm a man from the government and I'm just fucking shooting you without any provocation. But there's another one, which is they will occasionally shout, oh my God, they killed Alex.
Is it always Alex?
It's always Alex.
Never called Alex.
It's like, poor Alex.
Not another Alex.
Yeah.
Lost 10 this week.
Exactly. I think there's another name. I think I once heard like Sam or something, like a different name. But if they were going to go for the, like, we're going to make this feel really real by having them shout an actual name, they needed more lines. Because I've killed Alex like at least 5 times in 10 hours. But I remember every time it happens now.
He's a Necronic. He can't stay down.
Infinite Alex. That's the biggest fireman.
Lovely. Maybe that's giant fireman's called Alex. I think my favorite NPC bark ever was actually in the Darkness, the first Darkness game, which didn't come to PC, which is just...
Tom Senior's 6 out of 10.
Yeah, I've played them all. And it's a guy who just shouts, stick your face out so I can shoot you in the face. it's deliberately funny, but it cracks me up every time.
Good bark.
Yeah, top barks.
Kane then goes on to describe a great-sounding... Harvest Moon alike that didn't sell very well called World's Dawn, that I'd now like to play, I think we might actually just play and return to rather than go into his description of it, because we have many questions. Vincent writes, hello CNC, it's question time. It is. My Steam account is expanding all the time and titles come and go. Very few games are always installed on my computer due to the small capacity of my hard drive. And apart from Rocket League, CSGO, and Crusader Kings 2, there's only one game that is always installed and has been since launch. What is this masterpiece of a game, you might ask? Well, Rogue Warrior is certainly not a masterpiece and was for most part a great disappointment. And I have no idea how I managed to spend 237 hours in this game's campaign, whose lack of depth is amazing. Have a bad game like this that you just keep coming back to for some reason and just love in all of its shitty glory? Tom, this question is for you.
This is made for me. I've somehow put like 80 hours into Darksiders 2.
And some people just couldn't let THQ go.
That's like a 20-hour campaign, max, pretty much.
Really, max?
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I tell myself that I left my PC on overnight and that Steam clock has kind of counted it. But I think I'm lying to myself, really. I think I've just played that game loads. So I think some games become like comforting porridge, where it's like, there's so much choice. And all you want to do is just do something for an hour. And it's just like, oh, this really familiar thing that's just kind of comforting. And I get to do the same things. And it's kind of quite pretty and always enjoy hitting things in it. So yeah, I'm going to get back into that again. And then that's probably what happened with Darksiders 2. I don't know about this game though. I've not played it, but I'll now never play it. If it sucked this man out into it for 200 hours.
Yeah, it's crack for you.
It's the end. It's the end for me. It's the end of my productivity as a human.
I really liked Tomb Raider Legend and Tomb Raider Underworld. The last two before the reboot.
Legend, which one of them, were any of them near Anniversary? There was a kind of a remake.
It was Anniversary, Legend, and Underworld.
Okay, so that was after kind of...
But yeah, Anniversary, so they're all in the same engine, and they had roughly the same mechanics.
Yeah.
But like, Legend and Underworld were like, they were narratively linked, and they were like actual Tomb Raider stories. But I really liked the... They're not great. They're not good, really. They're fine.
Yeah.
But I sort of got into them enough that I sort of knew all their mechanics inside out and could, like, you know, do gold speed runs of levels and stuff.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons that I was so harsh on New Tomb Raider is it wasn't the 7 out of 10 game I really loved. It was a different 7 out of 10 game that I didn't like.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's probably as close as I've gotten to really investing in a... Because I think Tomb Raider Legend was the first game I ever got 100 gamer score in.
Oh, wow.
Oh, no, sorry, 1,000. Like,
you maxed out.
Completely maxed it, yeah.
Got it all. Yeah, it's rare that happens.
Yeah, I was working in a pub kitchen at the time and going home to play Tomb Raider. It was that time.
That time of young life.
Yeah.
Good.
Ben writes, "Greeting palettes and pry bars. After listening to episode 130, I thought you might be interested to know that there actually exists a game where the player controls a mosquito called Mr. Mosquito, released on the PS2 in 2001. Following along a similar line of questioning, what is your favourite game mechanic involving an animal, and why? Keep up the great podcast, Ben."
You've got die bombing it. You've got bomber owls in Far Cry Primal, don't you? That's pretty good.
Far Cry Prime Owl.
Prime Owl. And you've got those really good bits in Far Cry 4. Some of those beautiful moments where you went into a kind of, I don't know what it was, some sort of spiritual dimension where the trees were red and you controlled a tiger.
Shangri-La, wasn't it?
Shangri-La, yeah. It looked fucking extraordinary. And you could point a tiger at things and it would lunge at them and tear their throats out.
Yeah. Going very prog rock, that game.
It was good. I like that bit. But it was good.
Far Cry series is probably the standout here for good animals. Good animals. I would, trying to think if I could think of a different game. Fable 2, excellent dog.
Yeah, Fable 2 dogs are rad. Does the monkey from Black and White count? Do the creatures, the cow and stuff like that?
They're not really animals.
They kind of behave, they've got all the kind of mannerisms of like the ape, kind of apes around. And you know, it feels like an animal. It feels like a pet, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a little pink wolf that loved to dance. The shit kicked out of it by big animals.
That was the worst part, wasn't it? When your baby was like came up against an evil god and it just got totally pounded.
Yeah. I had a little pink rainbow wolf that would just get the shit kicked out of it. And I'd trained it somehow that every time someone tried to fight it, it would dance. It was really tragic.
Oh dear. You didn't train him for survival, did you?
The mirrors for my own life are profound. A kinder note on The Division, it has the dogs in it. Good ambient dogs that run around and poop.
Good dogs. They do, they shit very convincingly.
Someone's job was to make convincing shitting dogs for The Division, and they did. They fucking nailed it. Let's just get out there.
Absolutely.
Like, if that game's a 6 out of 10, you, sir, that you're 4 of them.
Oh, yeah.
Shitting dogs.
Man, good job.
Like, better than Watch Dogs. You can actually watch dogs in The Division, which is why it's the superior Ubisoft open world game.
Maybe Watch Dogs would have been a better fit for their...
universe.
For that idea, for that persistent university type MMO.
The hacking thing might have been tricky.
That'd have been a bit weird, wouldn't it? Everyone just causing blackouts all the time.
Yeah.
No, that's
traffic lights gone crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah. He has specified game mechanic involving an animal rather than just good animal.
Okay.
Does snarks count?
What's a snark?
The Half-Life. You know, the little fucking alien insect gerbil creature that you throw at people.
Is that the thing that attracts the ant lions?
No, that's Half-Life 2, Half-Life 1. You have like a bag of fucking space locust gerbils and you throw them at people.
God, I don't remember that.
Really?
No.
You can throw them into vents and they'll like have a really basic AI and they bounce around in a really cute way and then they kill people.
Oh my God.
You don't remember Half-Life, the video game Half-Life?
It's been a while since I played it.
Yeah.
That
game is almost 20 years old. I'm going to go with snarks. They're not a real animal, but I liked killing people with them. Yeah. They're really good in multiplayer because it doesn't work.
No one expects.
No, but because it simply doesn't work.
Oh, okay.
But if it does work, it's very funny.
Excellent.
Menthol Penguin writes, "In episode 101, you answered a question about what gaming would be like in 2017. There was a joke about The Division being about to come out, and another about Star Citizen still not being close to release. There was an answer about us knowing more about VR around Christmas, and probably a few more answers that I've forgotten. Now that The Division has released, we have pricing for the Vive, and people got to try it and give feedback at the PC Gamer Weekender. There's also pricing for the Oculus too. Star Citizen has been split up. No Man's Sky is out for pre-order. AMD has some interesting new tech slated for this year, and Intel and Nvidia must have stuff too. Microsoft revealed their UWPs recently as well, I say, plus all of the other stuff I've forgotten or don't know. Considering all this, I'm wondering how your predictions have changed for 2017 since that episode. Cheers, Menthol Penguin. Mass Effect's out in 2017.
Oh, yeah.
So that'll be exciting.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
2017, 2012 too. The return of 2012.
I think...
Mass Effect 3 was almost 5 years ago.
Oh, God. It's been an awful episode for...
Yeah. Time.
Time.
Time we got old in the space we've been in the city.
Father Time. Yeah. Time doesn't seem to move in Bath. I mean, that makes it more shocking somehow.
Yeah, it's always the same. Terrifying. Terrifying. Been here for 5 years. I've been here for 5 years. You've been here for slightly longer.
Shit. I think that 2017, I'll add a new prediction. I think Final Fantasy 15 will be announced for PC and still won't be out. Even though it's supposed to, it's rumored to come out in September.
I'd say we'll probably be looking at, I wonder if we'll get, like, this time next year, like, second-gen VR hardware announcements.
I'd hope so. I'd hope it would tick over a bit that quickly, yeah.
Hmm. What else will we know? We'll know if VR is popular, so we can stop having arguments about that on the internet.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of it's kind of obvious that it's not going to be mega popular, isn't it, for 5 years while it slowly grows and
although they did show that Star Wars demo at GDC.
Did look fucking rad.
I'm finding £600.
You're going to do it? You're going to do the Vive?
I might do. I've got a perfect room for it. And I did just buy a new PC.
Ah, damn. Perfect. You should do it. I'm leaning towards the Oculus now because, having tried the Vive at Weekender, I just don't have the space for it in my flat and probably won't ever be moving into a flat where I do have the space for it. But, it's really, really great. But I don't want to walk around in a headset. I feel really unsafe doing it. And it feels kind of big and uncomfortable. And there's wires everywhere. And and not being able to see your feet or kind of know properly where your feet are. It made me feel very, very unsteady, very unsafe. And I wasn't able to lunge around and do all the stuff that I was kind of hoping I'd be able to do. So I couldn't really, there's a game where you kind of duck and weave and shoot little drones that are attacking you and you kind of pull shields out and stuff. I was like, I kind of want to move around and do this properly, but I feel as though I'm literally going to fall over and die. And there was no nausea. Like that was what was amazing to me. It was the first one where I didn't feel any nausea playing it at all. It just felt natural. But at the same time, it feels like there's a lot of kind of still some psych stuff to figure out.
Yeah.
But I'm looking forward to see what they do with it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Other game-wise, we'll get a new Assassin's Creed next year, probably.
Yeah, after a two-year hiatus.
So that would be interesting to see if that becomes unshit. I would like... Given that Valve are putting out the lab for Vive, which is like an actual suite of VR games, apparently feels very much like a game made by Valve, which is really interesting.
Oh, fantastic.
It would be great to see them do something. I don't even want Half-Life at this point. I would just like them to announce something else.
Me too. I mean, it's a given every year, but if they're working on Left 4 Dead 3, whatever they're doing, like, just want to see something.
Yeah, I'm actually reasonably excited for Star Citizen as well, because I do love games like that, and I'd like to see it succeed, you know, given the investment. I'd like to see it come out in its bits and be good, particularly Squadron 42.
Yeah, that particularly is, I'll definitely play that after, because I loved Wing Commander 3. Really, really loved it. Had a lot of its nostalgia, but if they could recapture that, then it's still going to be lovely. I'm still going to enjoy it.
Yeah, so it's sort of hard to say, because I don't really know of any games other than Mass Effect that are definitely like now slated for 2017. It feels like we're in that sort of awkward period in the run-up to E3 where probably ask this question again in like 3 months and it'll be way easier to figure out what next year looks like, whereas at the moment it's very abstract.
Yeah, I'd hope that with Microsoft's push for kind of lots more Xbox games coming over to PC, that Platinum Scalebound might become a PC launch at some point. And we've sorely lacking in Platinum games. We had Revengeance and that was it. Pretty sure that's the only
Vanquish 2.
Oh, that would be good.
That's what I want to see.
That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
A great on game. PC. Sadly, will never come to PC.
No.
The only game with a button that you can smoke to distract the robot.
Yeah. I love that. And you're wearing a futuristic visor, so he has to pop his visor up before he can
have a fag. And you fight space Vladimir Putin on behalf of space much. Hillary Clinton.
Yeah,
it's good.
Video games, top video games.
It's actually probably an accurate document of the year 2017.
Yeah, who knows what 2017 will look like. It's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah. Or, you know, January we'll see the election of President Trump, and then we get to enjoy the post-apocalyptic dystopia that all of our video games have been training us for all of these years.
I'm going to hit the schema pretty hard.
Yeah, that's your first.
Yeah. That's me sorted.
And that's all of the questions we have time for. If you would like to send us a question for a future episode, you can email us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can leave a question on the forum at creightoncrowbar.com/forum, or you can tweet us at creightoncrowbar. If you'd like to hang out with us and the community on Discord, you can find a complicated invite link, as in the link is complicated, the process is easy, on the sidebar of the main site at creightoncrowbar.com. And that's it. If you want to follow us as individuals, I'm at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN.
I'm at PCG Ludo, which is LUDO. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yay.